verse 5, and it says that the daughter of Pharaoh went down to wash by the river, and her maidservants walked by the side of the river, right? And she saw the ark in the midst of the reeds, and she sent her maidservant, and she took it. Okay? That was the verse. So it says by the river, so Rashi has two explanations. One is the plain explanation, and he said the word al yad, literally it's on the hand. So he says yad is close to the body, so therefore the word al yad means near, close. They were close to the, they're walking close to the river. Okay? That's what Rashi says. The second explanation, he says our sages explain that walking comes from the word death. Why? Well, because it says in the Bereishis when Esav wanted some food from Yaakov, and Yaakov said, sell me the birthright. So he says, I am walking to death, or I'm going to death. So you see the word going is associated with death, so our sages says, over here, it's also walking to death. And what does it mean? Because objected to her saving the child, right? And the pasuk is the proof, because it says, why is it necessary to write altogether that the maidservants were walking? What do I care if the maidservants were walking? That is not necessary for the pasuk to get the information across. That is extra. And I said, I told you that the Midrash, it's not in the literal words, the Midrash, but however, it fits in according to a method of Torah that they had the right to take other ideas from Torah. In other words, besides the simple explanation, there was a method that was passed down from Mount Sinai, a way of analyzing it to get more information. Okay? The facts are probably based on the simple explanation. But however, we have the right to get more information. Okay? The question is who's going to death? Okay? So it says that the maidservants were walking, meaning that the maidservants were going to death. Right? Alright. So in other words, the maidservants were going to death. Okay? In other words, somehow they were going to die. Somehow the pasuk is saying that the pasuk is, according to the second explanation, says like this: the bonfire went down to wash by the river, and her maidservants were walking to death by the side of the river. Okay? They were going to die. Okay? We don't know why they're going to die yet, but however, according to our sages, that is the explanation of the pasuk. Now we have to understand why they're going to die. And Rashi explains why they were going to death, because they objected from saving the boy. In other words, that's the way they're learning it then. She is the princess. You object the princess, so you're going to die. You could get the death penalty. So they were putting their life in danger. Okay? That's... No, not by walking near the river where they put their life, but because, according to Rashi, they objected to what? To get the basket to save Moshe. The question is, why did they object? I thought Rashi doesn't say why, but it's probably because the law was that baby boys, Jewish boys, have to be killed. Okay? How they know it was Jewish, I don't know. I don't know. Whatever it was, they must, somehow they knew. I don't know. Okay? Rashi doesn't say. According to this, in other words, according to history, the maidservants went down because they were there to serve the daughter of Pharaoh. She was the princess. But why the Torah mentions this fact when the Torah does not mention anything extra? So Rashi says that's the proof for our sages' understanding that if they just weren't walking, why are they telling me they're walking? It should have said, the verse should have said, that they went down to wash by the river, and they saw the basket. That's all I have to say. They could have skipped this whole part. Why does it have to say the maidservants are walking? So therefore, Rashi said, it must mean that they're walking to death. And why are they going to die? Because it must be that they objected to Bas Paro saving Moshe. You see what I mean? So that is the that's what Rashi is explaining according to our sages the way the pasuk works. Once again, according to the plain shot, the pasuk should have just said. I mean, the plain shot is that Bas Paro, the daughter of Paro, went to wash by the river. Then it states the fact that the maidservants were also walking by the river. But then it says that she saw the ark. It said with she is singular, meaning the daughter of Pharaoh. Okay? And she sent the maidservant to take it. Right? That's the first explanation. The second explanation, and the daughter of Pharaoh went down to wash, and she wanted to save the child, and the maidservants argued with her and tried to object that she should not save the child. Okay? Why she did not kill the maidservants is not my problem. I don't know. She did not, but they put their life in danger by objecting. Okay? Now that we have the two explanations, the question is, why did Rashi give these? What's the difference? Since Rashi gives two explanations, whenever Rashi gives two explanations, there's always one subject that he's dealing with, okay? And also that he is, that there's two ways of seeing that subject, okay? So the question is, what is the difference between the first answer Rashi and the second answer Rashi? What is the difference? In other words, why did Rashi give two answers? What is the difference between the first answer and the second answer? The only factor that is different between the first answer and the second answer is that in the first answer, Bas Paro went down to wash. Then it states the fact about the maidservants, but the essence of the verse is she saw the ark and she saved the child, right? According to the second explanation, there was a discussion between Bas Paro and the maidservants. They objected to the saving of the child. So that is the only difference. Okay? So since that is the only difference, therein would lie what the difference between the first answer and the second answer is. So now we have to explain what is the difference. That's only the fact of the difference. Question is, what is the idea in the difference? I think the difference lies in the nature of the daughter of Pharaoh. Okay? I think that the subject is, what is the nature of Bas Paro, the daughter of Pharaoh? What is her nature? And there's two different possibilities. By what her nature is, I mean her personality, how she makes decisions. Okay? Again, the difference between the two. In the first one, Bas Paro went down, she saw Moshe's basket, and she sent one of her maidservants to get it, period. According to the second one, she went down to the river, and she had a discussion when she saw the ark she had a discussion with her maidservants whether she should save the baby. They objected. They said you should not. And she said, no, I'm going to save it. And then at that point, she sent one of her maidservants to get it. In other words, in the second one, the argument was she wanted to save the baby, and the maidservants did not want to save the baby. In other words, the Sifrei Chachamim, the commentary on Rashi, says that when it says that they objected, so it says the maidservants objected against Bas Paro that she should not save Moshe. In other words, they knew there was a baby there, and they were saying that, no, don't save him. In the second one, where they object, meaning that they must have given a reason why Bas Paro should not save the child, right? And yet Bas Paro, the daughter of Paro, still went out to save it. That shows a certain sense of justice and righteousness. Because the law of the land was that you're supposed to kill Jewish babies, okay? And so they objected to the saving of this child, you see? So it shows a certain level of justice. While the first part where there is no argument, I mean, it could also be justice, but it seems to be pointing, that's the question. What is the first one? Again, the difference between the first and the second one, when in the first one where it says the maidservants are walking, it's just like telling a historical event. But in the second case where the maidservants are walking to death, they're going to death, it means that they argued with Bas Paro. They put themselves on the line to keep the laws of the land, to keep the law of Paro, to kill every baby. You see? And the question is that if they disobey Paro, the maidservants, they die for disobeying Paro. If they argue with Bas Paro, they also have a chance of dying. The answer is no. They are the maidservants of the daughter of Paro. So the daughter of Paro has to take responsibility whatever happens. They're just obeying or disobeying the daughter of Paro. It has nothing to do. She's disobeying the law of the land. And the question is, what's the motive of the maidservants? Why are they? It could be they really were held from killing the Jewish baby boys. They really held from that, and they, of course that was the law of the land. And the Egyptians, we learned, the Egyptians wanted to destroy the Jewish babies. So maybe that's what they want them to do. We don't know about the maidservants. Could be that their purpose was not to save the daughter of Paro, to protect against going against the law of Paro. It could be they were doing it because they were vicious. And she stood up to their arguments, which shows a different type of personality, that she's willing to stand up for the idea of justice. And she argued with them, and she stood up to her father, who was the king. You understand? She went against the king. You see, she was taking a chance. So, but the thing is that you see a certain sense of justice. You don't see that in the first part. The question is, what do we see of a personality from the first part without the discussion? Because she's still standing up to her father. So the question is, what does it show us from the first part? Is it justice? I mean, you say it was curiosity because she saw the basket with the baby in it, so it was curiosity. Could be that's the possibility of the first, but the possibility of the first could be also a certain sense of justice, just there was no argument. So I don't know. So the question is, what does the first one seem to be pointing at? I don't know the answer. If the listener of this tape has an answer, they can work it out that way, then that would be fine. But I think there might be another possibility, okay? The other possibility, maybe it's telling us the nature of the maidservants, and in that way telling us the nature of the Egyptians at that time. Okay, in the first possibility, the maidservant just went along, whatever Phosphara was curious or just, we don't know. At this point, we don't know the nature of Phosphara. Some reason she wanted that ark, okay? But the, with the baby, okay? And the maidservant just went along, okay? So the maidservant just says that they were just submissive to whoever they were working for, they were submissive to that person. In the second possibility, they were so vicious against the Jews that they put their life on the line to argue with Phosphara, the daughter of Pharaoh. That makes more sense. In other words, it's telling us, the difference is telling us the nature of the Egyptian people, and it tells us through the maidservants of the daughter of Pharaoh. In the first half, they just went along whatever the king said. If the queen said it or the princess said it, they go along. That's it. They have no opinion, and they just went along. Pharaoh is the evil one. He's destroying them. But however, the nation went along. According to the second explanation, the people didn't just go along with Pharaoh, but the people were really... it's not that they just went along with Pharaoh. They were happy. They were vicious people, and they desired to destroy the Jew. And not only that, they stood up against Pharaoh to do that. So it shows the nature of the people of the land. That fits in better here, and it'll fit in better with the next verse, too. The first way you can't approach it, because you have to speculate about a motive, and it doesn't point to anything. But the second way is very, very clear, that the approach is dealing with the people of the nation. That makes more sense. The last time we learned Chumash, we changed our interpretation of the pasuk. I'd like to clarify the second interpretation. Okay? There are two explanations in Rashi. One is that the women, the maiden, Zipporah's daughter, was walking along the river, and they saw the child, and she sent one of them to get it. According to the second thing, they said they, when she sent somebody to get them, they argued. They said, don't save the child. Okay, they argued, and despite the fact that they argued, she outvoted them because she's the daughter of Pharaoh, and she saved the child. Right, so the question is, what's the difference between the first answer and the second answer? The answer is that according to both answers, we're discussing, the subject which we're discussing is the nature of the Egyptians. Okay, when Pharaoh gave the decree to kill the children, the Egyptians just do it because they obeyed Pharaoh, but they really didn't feel comfortable, or they were so much against the Jews, they hated the Jews so much that they would argue, they would try to argue with Phosphara not to save the child, even though their life would be in danger. Even though they hated the Jews so much that they were going to try to stop Phosphara, which would put their life on the line for trying to argue with Phosphara, she could just have him killed it like that, immediately. So the question is, what was the nature of the society? Was the nature of the society that they obeyed Pharaoh? They might have hated the Jews, but not to that extent. Or they hated the Jews to such an extent that they're even willing to put their life on the line not to save the Jew. In other words, this is not a democracy. If you disagree with her, she could have you killed for disagreeing. You see? So they put their life on the line by disagreeing with her. Okay, once again, just for clarification, there were two possibilities in the nature of the Egyptian people. Okay? One possibility is they did hate the Jews, they obeyed the king. That's it. They just obeyed the king, and if the princess wants to save the child, they wouldn't argue with them, and they just saved the child. Whatever the king or princess says, that's law to them, period. The second part, they had such a hatred of the Jew that they put their life on the line so that they could kill the Jew. That was arguing with Bas Parah, the daughter of Parah. Okay, we're doing the Rashi, the second Rashi in verse 5, where it says, and Amasa, okay? So Rashi has two interpretations for Amasa. One, the plain shot, the plain explanation, is she sent a maidservant. Then he says, our sages explain that it means a hand. What does it mean? It means... The second explanation, which is our sages interpret, that it means her arm lengthened many amas. An ama is a difference of opinion whether it's a foot and a half or 2 feet. So many, we want to say, is at least 3, maybe more. So if it's, you hold it's a foot and a half, so it lengthened 4.5 feet. Or if you say 2 feet is each ama, so it lengthened 6 feet. Okay, so arm stretched out. So she was able to reach it. Okay? First explanation is she sent out the maidservant. The second explanation is a hand stretched out 6 feet, so she was able to reach the child with her own hand and bring it in. Okay? That is the two explanations. Okay. There is a difference of opinion whether there could be such a miracle that so obvious a miracle that your hand stretches out, whether it could be a true miracle if it's not written in Torah. Okay? Some people hold that, yes, in certain situations, it wasn't told by a prophet, wasn't foretold by a prophet, so such a miracle could happen, but and it's not necessarily it has to be said in Torah. The said in Torah has to be foretold by a prophet. Okay? But however, according to the Ibn Ezra, if there's such a miracle that, an obvious miracle that a hand stretched out 6 feet or more to get the child, that's impossible because if it was such a big miracle, they would have written it in Torah. Okay? So according to the Ibn Ezra, I would like to try to explain this sage, according to our sage's interpretation, what it means that it stretched out for 6 feet, why they put it in that form. If it's impossible to happen, how the Ibn Ezra would interpret that interpretation of our sages. There are two, you have to understand there's two types of miracles. One type of miracle is where it's obvious, like her hand stretched out to 6 feet or 10 feet, whatever it was, to reach out to the kid.
Talking about
the daughter of Pharaoh's hand. Her hand, it says, her ama, her hand, stretched out. First hand says she sent a maidservant, which would be in the laws of nature, okay? But however, if her hand stretched out, the arm stretching, in that particular form, where there's such a miracle that it's so obvious, since the Ibn Ezra holds that it's not true, so according to the Ibn Ezra, it is possible. What happened is that she herself went out to the water to get the baby. She did not send her maidservant. Now, the fact that she went out and did physical work to get the child and didn't send her maidservant, that shows that God intervened. In other words, because there's a type of miracle where it looks like it's in the laws of nature, but it's not quite in the laws of nature. In other words, like where God, in other words, God caused her to go out to do it herself, which is against the system of the way it would work in Egypt. But however, the fact that the daughter of Pharaoh went out to do physical labor to pick up this box, you see, that itself shows that it's against the laws of nature. So there's what is known as an obvious miracle and a hidden miracle. So when our sages write the story like an obvious, the Ibn Ezra will say that it really, they're really writing it this way, but it really means a hidden miracle. And the hidden miracle in this case would be that the daughter of Pharaoh went out herself to save the child, so it shows that God was intervening in this situation. So the difference between the two explanations is the first explanation is simply in the laws of nature. She happened to notice their box, and she sent out her maidservants to get it. That would be the simple explanation. But according to our sages that say that her arm stretched out, since according to the Ibn Ezra, since it's not written in Torah, that couldn't have happened. So the Ibn Ezra is saying that's the way our sages write a hidden miracle, which would be, which is possible, that she went out herself to get the box, which would be against anything rational in that time, the way she would have worked. So therefore, that would show that God intervened, but in a hidden way, behind the scenes, but it wasn't an obvious miracle. Anyways, Rashi does not know if simply finding the baby was in the laws of nature or God intervened. But however, according to the Ibn Ezra, what it has to mean, that intervention was in a hidden way, not an open miracle. That's all. In Egyptian society, it would not happen that a king or a queen or a princess would do any work that a servant would do all their work. They didn't do anything. They were held like gods. They didn't do physical labor. That was done by everybody else for them. You see, that would be so much against the society that you must say that there was an intervention there. I mean, a godly intervention that God caused it. In other words, did God intervene because of Moshe? Or God allowed the laws of nature to happen, and Moshe was naturally saved. We're in chapter 2, verse 14, and the story is that after Moshe killed the Egyptian, and then he saw two Jews fighting, and when he says, "Why are you fighting?" So they said to him, what are you going to kill us like you killed the Egyptian? So Moshe says, so then it says that Moshe became frightened, and he said, therefore the thing is known. So what did he become frightened about? And what thing was known? So Rashi says, according to the plain meaning, I mean, he was afraid that people found out and Pharaoh was going to capture him and kill him. But however, Rashi has a interpretation based on the Medrash. Okay? It's slightly different. The Medrash says that because there were informers, therefore, they're not fitting to be redeemed. And what was known? So Rashi says that it's known to me, there was a question I always had, what did Israel sin that they deserved such a catastrophe happen to them? And he says, now I see that it's fitting that this should happen to them. Okay? The question is, what did Moshe understand in this story, Moshe understood something, why they don't deserve to be redeemed and why they deserve to be put in such a situation. We'd like to understand what that is, what Moshe saw. Now the answer is, there are certain acts that are self-destructive. Okay? For instance, let's say, for instance, a person is making money. He has greed, and he's making money, but through the way he makes money, he pollutes the land. So he's destroying the land, or he's polluting the air, and he's destroying the air, and because of that, he himself could get sick, and his family could get sick. So he closes off, because of his greed, he closes off certain truths, and he destroys himself. You understand? So a person becomes self-destructive. In other words, like this. Now, when a whole society is self-destructive, in other words, like in the case of Moshe, Moshe killed the Egyptian to protect the Jew, the slave. And then these people, when he reprimands them for doing an evil act, they turn on him and say, are you going to kill us? In other words, the very person that is helping them, you see, they turn upon him, which is self-destructive to themselves because they don't want to be corrected in their evil traits. In other words, Moshe is trying to correct them in their evil traits so that they should live a life of justice, and through justice and living the correct life, then you get strength and you're able to operate together as a unit. But once you become self-destructive and you can't work as a unit, that keeps you weak. And therefore other nations can control you when you are in a weakened state. As a nation, a weakened state is where groups of people can't work together within the same nation. That weakens the nation. So when the nation doesn't recognize that their strength is working together, and because of their petty emotions, they attack each other, and they even turn upon the person that's really out to help them when he tries to straighten them out, to get them out of their petty emotions, that they should live a correct life. So he says, therefore I see that it's impossible for them to get it. That's why they failed in the first place, that they were captured by the Egyptians, or kept by the Egyptians as slaves, because they couldn't protect each other. They were too involved in their petty emotions, and they can't be saved because they can't get together to organize themselves to work as a unit. There are groups of people that work as a unit that are very small, and they're able to destroy big nations that are divided, because division weakens the group, you see. So therefore, that's what Moshe is saying. He says, now I recognize the cause of their being put into slavery, and the same very cause doesn't allow them to be redeemed, to be freed, because they cannot operate as a unit, so they're so divided that anybody can control them, because they're out to get each other instead of joining together against the real enemy, namely the Egyptians. When I say divided, like let's say for instance, when an army divides, let's say into three parts, because that's the strategy, that is not separating, that's a coordinated plan where the group is there to work together. What I'm talking about is if I disagree with you about abortion, and you're going to be a doctor that makes abortions, so I'll kill you. It's a legal thing. Let's work it out legally. We're the democracy, so let's vote on it. There was a vote, or it went through the Supreme Court. Let's leave it at that. That's the law. But we start killing each other over things that we can't work together. Once you can't work together, that weakens the group. And once it becomes a point of weakness, then a smaller group that united is able to rip down the bigger group that's divided. Even a powerful group that's divided is weaker than a weak group that's working united together. And the question was asked, what gave Moshe the right to judge these people? These people are slaves, and Moshe is in his palace. And who is he to judge these people? They live, they have a different, in a slave world, and therefore, who is he to judge them? That is the question. The answer is, there are two ways of judging a person. One way I judge a person because of my situation. I have a better situation than you, and I look down on you because you have a bad situation. Okay? Secondly, I can judge based on objective information that I have. I look at the situation objectively, and it doesn't matter if I'm a different situation. If I'm totally objective about your situation and look at the situation correctly, then I would say, in other words, like this, in this case, he looked at the way Klal Yisrael, the nation of Israel, was operating. Says based on their operations, this is why they became slaves, this is why they can't get out of slavery, this is an objective investigation. He wasn't looking down on them that from his position as a prince, but he was investigating as a logical thing, why should this happen, as a logical question. You see? So therefore he's coming from a totally different angle. That you have the right to do. But we are on Exodus 2, chapter 2, verse 15, and it says that Paro wanted to kill Moshe. So Rashi says that Moshe was given over to the executioner, but the sword couldn't take effect on him. Didn't take effect. It's like the sword broke instead of his neck broke, okay? So... So the question is, if it was such a big miracle, then why wasn't it written in Torah? Right? I mean, is it such a big miracle that Moshe, the Paro wanted to catch, that Paro had Moshe and he tried to kill him and he couldn't kill him? I mean, that'd be a big miracle. So therefore, it should be written in Torah. The answer is, like all the, in many cases, where our sages mention a big miracle, it's either to be taken as a metaphor for something else, or when, especially when Rashi quotes it, then the second possibility is more appropriate. And the second possibility is that it was God's personal supervision. There are two levels where God intervenes with the laws of nature. One, he suspends the laws of nature. Let's say, for instance, in this case, Paro tried to chop his head off and the sword broke whenever it hit whenever it hit Moshe's neck. Okay? That would be a obvious miracle, the suspension of the laws of nature. But there's another type of miracle where it's like there's a certain direction that the laws of nature would have taken and God makes sure it doesn't go in that direction. That's a lower level of miracle, and many times that's harder to prove whether it's a miracle. The first one is an obvious miracle. The second one, you have to have knowledge of Torah to prove when it's really a miracle and when it's just the laws of nature. Rashi is saying that the fact that he escaped is that it was really, he shouldn't have escaped. Paro was this the most powerful country in the world, and he could have stopped them. But it had to have been, according, Rashi's quoting our sages here, that it must have been God's intervention, but not in a miraculous way, like a suspension of the laws of nature, but in a way that somehow that Moshe escaped all the guards, and he got away before they could capture him. You see? That it could look like the laws of nature, but yet God intervened that, in other words, Rashi is saying that according to the laws of nature, it really wouldn't have happened. But however, our sages are saying that God intervened, but it's not an obvious miracle. It's only that God changed the direction that he shouldn't have escaped, and and God made it that he should escape. What I am saying about the sword is not real. The sword was by his neck means that he was in a situation that was dangerous. It wasn't a literal thing that there was a sword on his neck, but the sword is a metaphor to represent the idea that there was a situation where he should have gotten caught, but he got out. But the reason why he got out is not because it was in the laws of nature that he escaped, but because God intervened, but God intervened in such a way that they missed him when he was running away, and he was able to get away, but God caused it. We're doing the next Rashi, which is, and Moshe sat on the well. So Rashi says it means literally sitting, not dwelling, because the word, the Hebrew word yeshay, could be either literally sitting, or it's used for dwelling. So Rashi says it means he sat on the well. And what's the understanding? He says that Moshe learned from Yaakov that just like Yaakov met his wife by the well, so he felt that he should also meet his wife by the well. So he met his wife by the well. The question is, what is this idea by meeting by the well? I mean, what is it, a magical thing that you should meet your wife by the well? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it sounds very funny. What this well thing? I would like to give a possible answer. Somebody mentioned to me that he's dating on the internet. So he dates on the internet, so he looks for somebody like a nurse or a teacher, that type of profession, because it's the type of profession where you do for others and you take care of others. So at least there's a possibility that they have a quality of where they think of others because they work with others. In other words, it's not a guarantee, and there's no guarantee if somebody is in another profession that they can't be nice to other people, but it's the probability rises when you get somebody from that profession that they think of others. So the same thing with the well. Who comes down to the well? The shepherds or the people that pick up the water to take to the house. So they do the work, they think of others. So it could be that that's what Moshe learned from Yaakov, that to get that type of woman that does her work because they think of others, so there's a better chance that they'd have that type of kindness, and that's the type of wife that he would want to marry. Somebody asked the question if that's the way I got my interpretation of this verse through that I heard about the dating, about the internet dating. The answer is yes. And according to the commentaries, to help you understand Torah, many times you need outside sources to help you understand the idea of Torah. So I'm just saying that just because you got it from an outside source, that doesn't mean it's wrong. You understand? Sometimes you need outside information to help you interpret Torah. You think? I think it's the Ibn Ezra that says openly that you need outside sources to help you interpret Torah. So yeah, definitely if you have an outside source for understanding Torah, definitely you should use it. We're still in chapter 2, verse 16, the first Rashi and the priest of Midian. So first Rashi just translates that priest means a leader. Doesn't mean literally a priest. But the second half says that he separated from them because he separated from the idolatry and they banned him or they excommunicated him. In other words, they didn't relate to him anymore. They stopped relating to him because he changed religions. Okay, does not say he took on Judaism. Could be he just took another religion, another idolatry, or he stopped worshiping idolatry. Okay, and the thing is, this fits in with the next verse, this explanation, because the next verse says that that they drove them, that the shepherds drove the girls away, the daughters away, because, so Rashi explains there, that it's because of the ban or the excommunication, so they couldn't relate to them. Okay? Okay, there are, you have to be careful, there are two types of excommunication. Because in Torah we also have excommunication, and in Judaism we have excommunication. I'd like to explain the difference between the two. Okay? In other words, the laws might be different in the excommunication slightly, but we have the idea of excommunication in Judaism, and we have the idea of excommunication in other religions. I'd like to define the difference. Okay, I'll give you, first I'll give you an example. In other words, let's say, for instance, a parent has a child that has a friend, and the friend, let's say, steals, or the friend is on drugs. So then the parent does not want the child to hang his or her child. The parent doesn't want the child to hang around with that friend to protect the child, right? It's to protect the child. Is that correct?
Okay.
But let's say, for instance, a person is a Nazi. The parent is a Nazi, and he doesn't want you hanging around with Jews or blacks. Okay. So the question is, what is the difference between these two parents? Okay, one is out of reality, where reality shows that there can be a harm in this relationship between your child and his friend. You see? And the Nazi is just bigoted, has a hatred for people, which is a non-good, and so therefore it's just a result of hatred. It's two different views of why you do it. So the question is, the question is that the Nazi thinks that he is doing it for a benefit, because this is his philosophy of life, this is his view of life. The answer is that there is what I think is right and what is objectively right. Okay? That's why we must always, we argue out all these different points to find out, to prove, and to see what is objectively right and what is right based on my feelings. And it objectively is not right. That has to be proven. So we're talking about an objective thing, not on the feeling. It's not on one person has this feeling and one half person has that feeling. You see what I mean? So therefore one is based on reality, that it really is based on reality that it's harmful to the child, and the other one is based on a hatred, and based on the hatred, I don't want my child hanging around with somebody else. The same thing with excommunication. The same thing is with excommunication. There is an objective reality where for certain reasons a person should be excommunicated. You see? And then there is a person is excommunicated because you disagree with me. In other words, two idolaters. Okay? So when the Kohen, when this person, it was Yisro, his name was Yisro, who changed his idolatry, okay, according to the Sifsei Chachamim, he changed his idolatry from this idolatry to another idolatry. You see? Both are wrong, you see? But however, I cannot tolerate if somebody has a different view than I do. It's not, my view is not based on reality, but it's based on a certain feeling that I feel this is the right view. He feels the other view is the right view. So it's just one feeling. The excommunication is based on a false view of life, and not tolerate anybody. It's really based on a fear. The fear is that maybe I'm wrong. You understand? It's a certain fear that I sense that it's idolatry, that it's wrong. And when you disagree with me, I feel you're showing me that I'm wrong. Okay? So, like, for instance, I'll give you an example. Let's say, for instance, I hold that jumping off a roof is dangerous to your life. And somebody comes over to me and says, look, I want to tell you that jumping off the roof is a great pleasure, and it's not dangerous, right? Okay? So I don't care if I don't jump, and he says, he's insulted, he says, you're stupid if you don't take this enjoyment, right? So I don't care, we can call me name after name, we can make me feel bad. I mean, I'm not going to jump off a roof. Okay? Now, when somebody has the ideas of Judaism and it's so real to him, it's equal to his reality. It's equal to his five senses. So then if somebody says, look, you're stupid for keeping this Jewish religion. It's just archaic. It's stupid. You can tell me whatever you want. It's not going to change my life. I mean, I know the truth, you see. But if I don't have a proof for my religion, I accept some idol that I don't have a proof for it, so there's a certain sense, since I don't have a proof, that maybe I'm wrong. Therefore, most idolatry, they went out to capture other nations and to change their view because of a certain insecurity of their own religion. So when somebody pulled out of their religion, you see, so permeated insecurity, especially this was a leader, so it was a terrible insecurity. So what they did was is they joined together and say, you are wrong, we're not going to deal with you, and you're excommunicated, you're separated totally from the community, we're not going to relate to you. And like in the next verse, when the daughters came to water their sheep, they were chased away, they were looked down on and pushed aside, you see? So therefore it's based on my emotion, it's a denial. The excommunication is based on a denial of reality. The source of the excommunication is different than the Torah source of excommunication. The Torah excommunication is based on reality, and there's certain situations that are totally damaging, you see, to Judaism. I'll give you an example of the type of person we excommunicate. Okay? They say that Spinoza was excommunicated. Okay? Okay? According to history, there was a court that got together and excommunicated Spinoza. Now, you never find in Torah, Spinoza was a philosopher who, he was Jewish, and he turned away from Judaism and created a new philosophy of how the world works, different than Judaism. Now, you never find in Judaism that we excommunicate people that have a different view, that argue with us. Even if they were religious and then they become non-religious, we don't excommunicate them. What happened was that Spinoza was trying to teach others his philosophy, and because he was a genius, he would make people have doubts about Judaism. He was starting to affect the regular people in Judaism. So therefore, to protect, like the child, we have to protect our people. So therefore, we excommunicated him so people shouldn't hang around with him and they shouldn't learn his false ideas. Okay? So therefore, you really see that excommunication is not because they have a different philosophy. It's only because they're harming our people, like protecting the child. So that's the situation of excommunication, you see? But we're continuing from yesterday. We're explaining the difference between when other nations put a person in excommunication or cherem and when we put a person in cherem. There is the case of Spinoza that he had a different philosophy of Judaism, and there was a court that put him in cherem. Now the question is, if somebody disagrees with our religion, We don't put a mecherem for that. There are many Jews and non-Jews that disagree with our religion, and we do not excommunicate the person. We don't put him in excommunication. So the question is why they put Spinoza in excommunication. The reason why they excommunicated him is because he was talking to people that weren't into philosophy and they couldn't protect themselves against his questions. That he didn't have the right to do. Therefore, we had to protect our people from him. So therefore, we excommunicated him. We do not excommunicate a person because he has a different view than us. We excommunicate him if he's trying to harm people in our religion. It's the same example that we gave, that a parent will not let you hang around with a kid that's affecting you. If I don't let my child hang around with somebody that's nice and not affecting him in an adverse way, but I just don't like because he has a different religion or because he has a different color, so that is wrong. But if he's harming my child, I have the right to say, no, you can't hang around with him. Spinoza was harming the people of Judaism by questioning them, and they didn't have the ability to argue back. So therefore, they excommunicated him. But in other religions, they excommunicate. If you have a different view than them, they excommunicate. We don't excommunicate you if you have a different view. Okay? We excommunicate you to protect the society. In other religions, they excommunicate you because you have a different view. We're doing chapter 2, verse 21, Rashi. Rashi's first answer, he says, like the translator, okay? And by the translator, he means that it means like the simple shot, plain explanation, that Moshe consented to live with him. Fine. The Medrash says, according to Rashi, that the word Yoel is a term of oath, and Moshe swore to Yisrael that he would not move without his permission. Now the Medrash and Medrash Rabbah, it writes extra there, so I'd like to read to you. It says, Rebbe Yehuda says he swore to him, and why did Yisrael force him to swear? Why do you want them to swear? Because Yisrael, said to him, I know that Jacob, your ancestor, when Laban gave him his daughters, took them and left him without his knowledge. I am afraid if I give you my daughter, you will do the same to me. Whereupon Moses swore at once, and he gave unto him Zipporah. Okay? Moses swore that he won't go without his permission, and at that point, Yisrael gave him Zipporah as a wife. Okay? The question is, so what if Yaakov ran away? I mean, what? So what? So he left with his wives and he moved away. Okay? That was Yaakov. This is Moshe. Yaakov. The question is, what does Yaakov have to do with Moshe? Yaakov, for whatever reason, ran away. Alright? Whatever reason. He ran away. Well, what does that have to do with Moshe? What does that have to do with Moshe? Israel said, look, I know that your forefather, Yaakov, that's around 250 years ago, before this incident with Moshe, that's 250, someplace between 250 and 300 years before. So the thing is that Yaakov did this, okay? Says, so I feel that you should swear to me, you shouldn't run away. I mean, what does one thing have to do with the other? There are two possible answers. One is that Yisrael did not know the circumstances of why Yaakov ran away. Okay? Why Yaakov left. He didn't know the circumstances. He just knows historically that Yaakov left without permission, and he felt this might be a family trait. That's one possibility. A family trait. And when you get married, a person should be aware if there is a family trait. In other words, when a person gets married, okay, not only should you watch the personality of the person that you're marrying, whether man or woman, you know, you would decide, you understand? But the thing is that also the family might have certain traits. You should be careful. These traits could be affected, could affect descendants, you see? So he felt that Yaakov might be that it was a certain family trait, exactly what trait was, but like you roam, like you go from one place to another, or something like that. I mean, Yaakov did roam, and Israel traveled around. I mean, first Yaakov lived in Canaan, then he went to Laban, then he came back from Laban, then he traveled around the country, then he went to Egypt. So he thought maybe it's a trait that they just traveled. So he says he wanted to protect himself. He wanted to protect himself that they should just get up and leave based on this family trait. So therefore he asked Moshe to make a note. There are two ways of getting the traits of your parents. One is you raised in your parents' house, or you raised by, or your grandparents were there, so both of them affect you. But there are certain traits that are inherent in certain groups of people, that they live a certain way, and they have certain styles that they live by. And so therefore, because of that, it's a trait that is passed down through generations, not so much as taught, but it's there within the, I don't know if it's genes, I don't know how it works, but it definitely is. There's certain nations that the whole nation, or tribes, in those days it was tribes, the whole tribe has certain type of personality. Okay? The United States is different, slightly different, because there's so many different groups of people living together. But you should know that people have, you know, you have to look back, not just that they're American in this generation, but sometimes generations in the back, they do have a, they do have certain traits that they picked up from ancestors, should be aware of it. In other words, they were looked at that point as travelers, like nomads. That's what he saw from Yaakov. Yaakov was here, Laban was there. They traveled, you understand? So therefore, he might have held that because of that trait of being a wanderer, so therefore, Moshe would also wander. Okay? So that's one possibility. Second possibility is that Yisrael did know the reason why Yaakov left. The second possibility is that Yisrael did know the reason why Yaakov left. And if you remember, Yaakov told his wives that he's not getting along with his father-in-law. His father-in-law is very depressed, very jealous of him because Yaakov became very wealthy. He became very wealthy, and Laban was jealous of him. Okay, and there was a conflict in the family. So therefore, Yisrael was afraid like this. There are two reasons why you leave. One is my relationship to you is not a good one. The son-in-law and the father-in-law don't have a good relationship. Sometimes there's an outside factor. Like, for instance, later on, since you see that after the burning bush, it says that Moshe went to Yisrael to ask him for permission to leave. Because once he swore that, I won't leave without your permission, so you had to ask him for permission, you see? So he said, fine, okay? So he let him go. But that was an outside circumstance, you see? I think what Yisrael, according to the second possibility, what Yisrael was afraid of, is that, let's say there's a conflict between, okay, so you live your place, but don't take my daughters away. I want to see my grandchildren. It's not like today in the United States where you can call on the phone, where you can take a plane and get there within less than a day. In those days, I mean, if you moved away, you didn't see your family at all. So he says that if there insofar it's possible, I don't know why Yisroel decided, I'm just giving two possibilities of what he saw. What is the second possibility is that he was afraid of the reason that Yaakov left. Yaakov left, what was the reason? Because I can't get along with my father-in-law, so let's go. I mean, I can't live here. I mean, the guy's depressed. He's constantly jealous of me. I'm better off leaving. I can't work with the guy. So he says, insofar as our relationship, that's what he learned from Yaakov, that insofar as our relationship, don't make a decision to leave for that. You see? But then when Moshe came, that he had to leave to go back to save Klal Yisrael, that was a different reason already. That was an outside factor. Okay? So it could be that that's the reason what he saw. These are the two possibilities that why he made Moshe swear, and he attached it to Yaakov according to the Medrash. The verse, we're doing chapter 2, verse 23. The verse says that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel groaned from the work. Okay? So Rashi says, what does it mean he died? It doesn't mean literally he died. It means he had tsaras. Tsaras is a disease caused by God. It's not a physical disease. It's caused by God. As a result of this disease, because he couldn't find a natural cure, there was no natural cure, so what he did was, for a cure, he slaughtered the children of Israel, and he washed in their blood. Okay, he bathed in their blood. Yes, he washed or bathed in their blood. The question that you're all asking: how did he even begin to think that washing in blood is going to cure him? Okay, and the question is that Chaim asked is that how could we know why Paro would use blood? I mean, there could be many different reasons that they had at that time, and we do not know the reasoning why they did it, so how could we even start to give an answer unless we have background or certain facts about Egyptian culture per se? That is Chaim's question. The answer is that we do not know. I mean, maybe there is information that I'm lacking. Maybe you could find out. But we're only giving information. I'm only going to answer the question based on the way the ancient people in generally acted and related to different things. Okay? And what we know about ancient people and how they related to different various areas of blood. Okay? When the ancients used to go to war, and they would win a war, they would drink the blood of their enemies. Okay? The reason for this is not that they were so as gory, you understand? But the reason is that they held that blood was the source of life. And these people, their enemy, fought courageously, and so they would drink their blood to take over the source of the enemy's life and to take over the good qualities of courageousness and valor in war. So therefore, they used to drink, in their view, blood represented the source of life. And so therefore, by drinking the blood, they would be gaining the source of life. Now, Alejandro mentioned the case about a queen or royal person that used to bathe in blood to feel young, you see? To feel young, you see? Now, the thing is that if blood has this component of the source of life, then by bathing it will keep me young. And the same thing with Paro, since he had a skin disease, psoras shows up on the skin, so he bathed in the blood so that it would give him back a source of life. It give him cure him, because the source of life would give him a cure. Okay? Now, to prove that the Torah really holds, that Rashi held, that this was the interpretation, because Rashi says that the verse uses the term that Paro died, and then the commentaries bring proof that it has to be tzaras. It couldn't be death, literally. They bring different proofs, okay? So the thing is that since he held that he was dying, that's a rust. He looked at it as a death, causing death. He needed the cure to something, that the source of life that would take away death. You see, the queen also wanted youth. Old age is leading to death, and that queen bathed in the source of life, namely blood, to remove the old age, the cause of death, so that she would be young, young again. And so did Paro. He had tzaras, which he felt there was no cure for. And so therefore, he bathed in blood, because he saw it was leading to death, so he bathed in blood, because blood is the source of all life. That's the way they looked at it. The source and strength of life. The question that is being asked, what's the difference between drinking blood or bathing in blood? Okay? In other words, why didn't Paro just drink the blood? Why did he bathe in the blood? What's the difference between the two? It is possible to answer the question like this. When they went to war and they would drink the blood of their enemy, they're interested in getting his qualities, like courage and valor. You understand? So therefore, the blood was the source of all his traits, so he would drink the blood to get his traits. But however, in the case of the queen that used to kill her servants, to use the blood of a servant, or Paro uses the blood of the children or infants, that is, he doesn't want their traits, you see. He wants a cure. So therefore, when it's to acquire the traits, then he drinks the blood. But when he doesn't want the traits, and he only wants a cure, as a cure he bathes in the blood. That could be a possible distinction.
In the verse it says that Paro died, and yet the commentary said that he had this tzaras, the skin disease. Okay, so the thing is that you see that that he held he was dying. Okay, so therefore, when you're dying, so then you want to bathe in blood, so that you that will cure you of the disease. But internalizing the blood, then you're internalizing the personality of the people. So therefore, when you went to war, they respected their enemies, and because they respected their enemies, because of their valor and their courage and their warring traits, so they internalize it. But for a cure, where they didn't want to get the personality of the slaves, they didn't want to internalize that, so for a cure, For dying, they needed the source of life, but they needed the source of life because that's why it says that he died, meaning that he needed the source of life to come back, and therefore they bathed in it. They bathed in it in the source of life to undo the ailment. Hey, please skip over to the next. Discussion, which will be on the tape recorder. The number will take 110. The number on the tape recorder, which takes 8 minutes.
We're doing the first Rashi in the first verse.
And it says Moshe was herding his sheep of Yisrael, his father-in-law, the leader of Midian, and he guided his sheep far into the desert. Okay? So Rashi is bothered, why did he go far into the desert? What caused him to go far into the desert? So Rashi answers, to distance himself from stealing. So he, now what did he mean that he wanted to distance himself from stealing? That he should, that the sheep should not graze in the field of others. Okay? So that's how he wanted to protect himself. So we have to ask a question. Now, definitely Moshe did not want to steal. So he wouldn't have purposely brought his sheep into the field. Okay? What if he saw one of his sheep grazing in the, somebody else's field by mistake? What would he have done? He'd have definitely got the sheep out, and since he definitely would not violate stealing, so he definitely approached the guy and paid for it. So therefore, you must say that he's worried about a situation where Moshe was worried about a situation where a sheep might eat in somebody else's field and he would not be aware of it. So Rashi is telling us the level of justice that Moshe had. That Moshe was on a very high level of justice. In other words, you have to understand Moshe's mission is going to be a life of justice for doing the best for Israel. And therefore, he must have this trait of justice. And that's what Rashi is telling us, how far Moshe would go in so far as protecting himself from stealing from others. Marcus wants to say, which is very possible, that when it says the desert, in other words, he might have been taking, to avoid stealing, he's also taking his sheep to a more difficult place to graze to avoid stealing. So Marcus is showing how great Moshe was even in that he would avoid stealing even to the extent that it's going to take him longer and go, he's got to travel far distances to get enough pasture for his sheep. And I think that is possible. It's probably also implied in Rashi. This is chapter 2, verse 24. In Exodus, and it says that God heard their moaning, in other words, the cries of Israel, and God remembered his agreement with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then it says God saw the children of Israel, and God knew. Okay? Now it uses four adjectives about God. It says heard, remembered, saw, and knew. Okay? And so these are definitely metaphors. So we would like to discuss the metaphors. I think I can explain three out of the four. Okay? The first one is God heard their cries. Okay? The question is, what does that mean? It says God heard, but God doesn't do anything. He doesn't do anything until the next few stages, okay? But at this point, he just hears their cries, and he doesn't do anything. So again, the question is, what is the hearing, and why doesn't he do anything? To answer the second question, why he didn't do anything, that goes back to chapter 2, verse 14, where it says that the two people were fighting, and Moshe intervenes, and they say, what, are you going to kill us like you killed the Egyptian? And it says, Moshe was frightened, and he said, therefore the thing is known. And according to the second interpretation of Rashi, It means that it's known that they do not deserve to be saved. Okay? They're people that are in trouble, but just because you are in trouble, that doesn't mean you deserve to be saved. Okay? And Moshe saw clearly that they didn't deserve to be destroyed, and God didn't do anything here because of the same reasoning, that they did not deserve to be hurt. I mean, they do not deserve to be helped. Okay? However, the word Vayishma, and he heard, God heard, means that God was aware of their crying. God is aware of everything that goes on. That is one of the basic principles of the Torah, that we must accept the fact, based on the knowledge of Torah, that God is aware of everything. And God was aware of their cries, but however, God did not do anything because they did not deserve to be helped by God. Okay? Now, the second thing is that he remembered means that the reason why God would intervene only would be because of his agreement with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In other words, the Jews in and of themselves did not deserve to be saved. The way they lived their life, they did not deserve to be saved. But however, they did deserve to be saved because of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Okay? And Vayar, and he saw God, so I do not know what that means. I don't know what that means. Anyway, and the last one says, and God knew. Okay? Rashi says, and God knew. It says he focused upon them, and he did not hide his eyes from them. Okay? In the Torah, where God hides his eyes, it means that God does not relate to you personally. In other words, there is a certain punishment against Israel where God, there's no personal relationship between Israel and the nation, between Israel and God. God does not relate to Israel except that he will not let the nation disintegrate. That's his only relationship with them. But otherwise, there is no involvement. Like a lot of people ask, why isn't there prophecy today? Why don't we have miracles today? The reason is because we're not on the level for God to relate. Just like Egypt, they weren't, even though they were in deep trouble, they didn't deserve to be saved. At a certain point, for whatever reason, God gets involved, not because of the way Israel is living their life, but because of Abraham, Isaac, because of his agreement between Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that this nation will represent God on earth. Okay? So when it says he did not close his eyes, that it says that God knew, it means that God was now going to get involved. Okay? We don't know the step between